This is the Early Edition Podcast with Phil Johnson on AM1150.ca and across the Bell Talk Radio Network.
Canada's labor market job reports came out today. Statistics Canada, as they do once a month, putting out the job numbers so we get some sense of what is going on with the national economy, what's happening with unemployment across the nation. Lord knows these numbers are far more critical now as we try to maintain some sense of what's going on within the Canadian economy. Who better to talk to than the Business Council of British Columbia? Ken Peacock is their chief economist. And we have the privilege of talking with him once a month to get some sense, get his take on these numbers. Ken, good morning to you. I appreciate you being here.
Good morning, Phil. Happy to be here.
So the labor market, according to Stats Canada, gained almost a half million jobs, 419,000 jobs to be exact. That's a big lift, and a lot of people were wondering what was going to be happening.
Yeah, no, it's overall, it's a good report, because I completely agree. It was really unclear exactly what was going to happen, because there was a big jump the previous month as the reopening started up the previous month or a little bit before that. So it wasn't clear whether we were going to see another big lift or a slowdown. Here in British Columbia, we saw employment rise by 70,000 jobs. So that's a big number. But in the context of the swings we've had, it's not massive. So it's a slowdown from the previous month. But it's kind of right in line of what I was thinking and hoping that we would see, and that is that continual increase in employment as employers recall employees back to work with the reopening. So in that sense, good news on a path that I think is good for British Columbia.
So as Stats Canada releases this, and I have no idea of the format or how it looks as they send the numbers out, they arrive in your computer, and so you have the chance to do the deep dive, the drill down, and analyze. But most of these are obviously jobs that existed. Somebody was laid off because of COVID-19, a business shut down, whatever. And now are this number that we're dealing with, 419,000, do you have a sense of how many of them are callbacks? How many of them are people who already worked in that job and now being brought back?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. We don't have hard numbers on that. It's difficult to get a sort of a pulse on that. But I can say with near certainty, the vast, vast majority of these are callbacks. Business formation creation of firms is happening. It hasn't stopped entirely, but it's slowed down dramatically. So just that churn in that process, we're seeing more business failures and fewer business creations. In fact, StatsCan came up with a report yesterday that said precisely that. So I don't think on the new job creation there's that many. This is predominantly people being recalled back to their work. The previous employment.
Okay, so then what do we extrapolate from that? You know, I keep hearing about the deep V economy. If I'm getting this right, we've hit the bottom. We're going up the other side of the V.
Sure, we're going up the other side of the V. I would step back and hesitate to call it a V, and I think perhaps this employment report speaks to that, because we saw a bigger rebound, not quite twice last month, but we saw a much more significant rebound last month. And so we've already seen some tempering in the pace of job creation. I think as we go later into the year, we're going to see additional tempering. So we're not going to see these 50, 60, 70,000 month-to-month increases. We're going to start to see maybe 10 or 15 or 20. So a slowdown there. And we could even see some job losses later in the year as the sort of global economic slowdown takes a grip and starts to wash up on BC's shores. So, overall, the trajectory is welcome, but I don't think we're going to continue to see it, and we're still going to end up in a big hole in terms of employment at the end of the year, Phil. I'm pretty certain about that.
Well, I mean, if you take a look at Vancouver and the foundation of business in Vancouver, yes, the resource extraction industry and the shipping industry and so on, but the reality is that those cruise ships arriving, bringing $1 million per ship into the local tourism economy. I saw all kinds of stories of businesses who said, we've given up, we can't wait. We see how many cruise ships are being canceled. And likewise here in the Okanagan. Again, we had a pretty good Canada Day holiday, and we had a pretty good BC holiday. But again, we've got a long way to go before we're going to even begin to feel what we used to be like.
Right, right. And this is precisely the problem. The cruise ship industry thing is really, really concerning. And because I was chatting with somebody the other day, it's not too often that in an industry or sector that you see activity fall from being very vibrant, you know, more than 100 ships coming into the harbor every year to zero. You know, recessions, things tend to retrench and slow down, but falling right to zero is almost unheard of. So, yes, some very, very big challenges in much of the tourism space.
You know, just as only because we're a little bit philosophical here, I think our world is not going to look like the world that once was. I mean, Virgin Atlantic Airlines, British Airways, Air Canada, WestJet, the number of fleets that are being cut in half. Air travel is going to take a long time to begin to look like it once was. So if you take that and you extend that out to the cruise ship industry, you extend it to the hotels and bed nights in our backyard.
Yep, yep.
You know, for people who do what you do, which is, you know, sort of look at the economic play, the charts, the graphs, and then try to project, does anybody really have a handle on what it's going to look like?
No, there's a great deal of uncertainty. I think that's absolutely the case. On the travel thing, if one thinks about it, you've got the recreational travel, the tourism travel, which has obviously been hit very, very hard. But then business travel has also essentially dried up and stopped. And I think to your point about how the world may be permanently changed, I don't think perhaps, you know, when there's a vaccine or something, I don't think necessarily businesses are going to go back to the same kind of level of travel across the country for meetings that they did prior to the pandemic, because they've learned that these Zoom meetings and these Microsoft Teams meetings are actually quite effective. So I think that's absolutely an example of a situation where you're going to see a very, very significant shift coming out of the other side of this. And it's going to be gradual. It's going to unfold over many, many years. But the impact and the shock that got us here was very, very quick. But the recovery process and the industries that grind and are hurt and gradually decline in output will be replaced by industries that expand, but that process could be very, very slow and very time-consuming.
Ken Peacock, Chief Economist with the Business Council of BC, always appreciate your opportunity to talk with us, or our opportunity, rather, to talk with you as Stats Canada releases the job report for this country. And 419,000 jobs recovered last month as more parts of the economy have started to reopen, re-energize, rebuild, redirect, and move forward. The report is available at the Business Council of British Columbia. Appreciate Ken Peacock's time and attention.
This is the Early Edition Podcast with Phil Johnson on AM1150.ca and across the Bell Talk Radio Network.
Canadian Junior Football League have canceled the 2020 season because of COVID-19. Just another on a huge long list of events and competitions, sports events and so on that are being canceled because of COVID-19. Reaching out this morning to Brent Crisco, he is the president with the Okanagan Sun football team, to get some sense of how this is being handled within the Sun organization. Good morning to you, sir, and I really appreciate you being here. As I said just a second ago, you're here for all the wrong reasons. This is a story that truly saddens me. I've always looked forward to the Okanagan Sun.
Yeah, good morning, Phil. And yes, I wish it was under different circumstances, but always nice to chat with you.
So how does this come together? Do the various teams across the country, you know, engage by Zoom or by phone, and everybody sort of gives a snapshot of to where they think things are? Or how was the decision arrived at?
Yeah, well, what we did is it was a process of about 4 months in terms of a number of phone calls, and we touched base with our league, so the BCFC. And then we decided on a deadline, and that was August 5th. And what happened two nights ago was that all three conferences, so the BCFC, the PFC, and the OFC voted. And the majority from all the conferences was that we were going to cancel at this point, unfortunately. It was disappointing, but yeah, all conferences did put input in. And then Jim Pankovich, the commissioner, did put out a release yesterday announcing that decision.
Are part of this, I mean, you know, we recognize the CFL is attempting to start up, and I want to come to you there in a couple of minutes, but the CFL is trying to get started again. NFL is obviously getting ready to amp up and go. It seems that there are various formulas that are being tried by various sports leagues to bring the game back. Would those costs have been prohibitive for each of the franchises? I mean, do you look at that from a, listen, we'd love to come back, the guys want to come, but for us to put in place the kind of protection that's needed, we just don't have the funds to do that?
Well, I mean, you're correct. I mean, first of all, I mean, we are a gate-driven league, so we needed fans in the stands. And with only maximum now of 50, in terms of outdoor gatherings, I mean, that
Whoa. Are you telling me that that rule of 50 people gathered together applies to you as well when you look at the size of the grandstand at the Apple Bowl?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. For sure. We need those fans in the stands. So we needed, we're gay driven. Yeah.
But Bonnie Henry says, no, you're only allowed 50, and Starlight Drive-In's only allowed 50 cars and this thing. But never mind that you've got 500 seats, but you're going to only be allowed to put 50 people in there.
Right. And now, having said, there was talk about that number going up. We can socially distance at the Apple Bowl. You know, there's room around the track and all that. But we needed to have that fans because we do rely on that gate. Revenue, so that is important. And then also, you talked about testing. We would all like the formulas that you're seeing right now in the professional leagues are running without fans. We need fans, and they're being tested regularly. So those are two things that add costs. And unfortunately, when you're a not-for-profit, those costs add up.
Never mind the fact that you're also trying to protect the young men who are coming here from all over the country, their mums and their dads or their families are releasing them into your care. I can't imagine what the costs of protection or providing those insurance factors would be to you. So, again, I can sort of see the economics of it. They just don't exist, do they?
Correct. I mean, the safety of our players, coaches, and our coaching staffs make it harder to compete in 2020 for sure. And then one other thing, Phil, so I'm not sure if you're aware or not, but so football and sports now is in phase two. We are not in the competition stage, which is phase three yet. So in order for us to get there, it was going to be about another month or so, and we still didn't get an exact date on that. So right now those two, the gate driven factor as well as the being only in phase two right now, those were the two big contributing factors to making that decision.
So does your coaching staff have to reach out to all those individual families, those individual young men, and say, listen, you know, you've probably heard the news, but I just wanted to reach out and say we're so sorry you couldn't be here this year?
Well, fortunately, we have a great coaching staff. So Jamie Borum is our head coach, and this came together very late on Wednesday night. I sent him the press release, and then first thing Thursday morning, Jamie had sent out already an email with the press release from the CJFL announcing to all of our players, coaches, and staff about what had happened. So he's been very good. He's been on top of it. I mean, and he had a great recruiting year. So, I mean, hats off. We had a board meeting last night. Jamie was there, and we obviously thanked him for his efforts so far this year.
Can the league, can the individual franchises take a year off like this?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, we talked about that last night at the board meeting. I mean, football, we need to continually, the sport of football needs to keep players and the community engaged. That's the bottom line. So what on our operational side, Jamie wants to continue running some camps. So like I said, in that phase two, we can run camps. But also we need to be still active in the community because we still need to fundraise. And that's the bottom line, Phil. I mean, we still need to actively be out fundraising. That's the bottom line.
Okay, so I want to tell you right now that when you're ready to move forward with a game plan, I probably can't have you in the studio because Bell's been very specific about not being able to have people in the studio. But when you're ready to go, you let us know, because I want to help lead the charge to encourage businesses and business leaders in the community to stay involved, to be involved, to ensure that the long, long history of the Okanagan Sun franchise continues within this community.
No, we appreciate that. And you guys have been good supporters of the team and in the past, and we continue working in the future. So, we would open that to that opportunity, and we'd look forward to that, Phil.
So, if you'll permit, and if I'm going to blindside you here, that is not my intent. So the minute I say that, your reaction is he's going to blindside me.
Oh no, I've had my coffee.
Okay. As the CFL is still trying to find its way, it would appear right now that the CFL is saying to the federal government, if you can't advance it's millions of dollars, isn't it? It's at least hundreds of thousands of dollars. Without it, there isn't going to be a CFL. Your reaction to that side of this football equation?
Well, I guess first off, it does, first of all, impact our league. So I'm not sure if you know, but at a BC Lions game, when you do buy a 50-50 ticket, 50% of that does go to actually back to junior football. So so we do have an interest, meaning we want football to go ahead in terms of CFL, and we think the sport in Canada, we want it to go ahead. But in terms of the actual financing side, it's a reality now in football. I know the CFL is asking for an interest-free loan. But on the other hand, we have to look at our football, our business model, and it has to change. I mean, we have to look at other ways. I mean, right now, Phil, you're seeing online 50-50 sales, to use the hockey example, are going through the roof. And maybe these are some things we have to consider, and maybe the CFL has to consider at that point too, to stay viable and to stay visible in our community. Because I think football, from the professional league all the way down to our league, needs to stay in the forefront of people's minds.
Wouldn't you just love to be able to have half of the Edmonton Oilers' $2.7 million was the half.
I'm coming into your studio then, Phil. Tell your management I'll be there. But yeah, no, I mean, that's what I'm saying. I think through this COVID situation, there has been other opportunities that have arisen, and there are things that, you know, we need to think more creatively. And this is, I think, one of them. And the thing I will say, the caveat with the 50-50 is they do have different regulations each province. And so if they do decide to do the bubble, which is in will be in Winnipeg, they have to make sure that it's meets all those regulations, and we would do the same here.
Brent, I so appreciate your time. Brent Crisco, who's the president of the Okanagan Sun Football Organization, where yesterday they had to announce that that the season is done. It isn't going to happen. And overall, the impact on junior football right across this country and ultimately Canadian Football League as well.
This is the Early Edition Podcast with Phil Johnson on AM1150.ca and across the Bell Talk Radio Network.
If you're not aware that Ellen DeGeneres is in serious trouble, you've been doing the Rip Van Winkle thing or living in a log, or you've been in a coma for a little while. The reality is that the golden girl of daytime television, Ellen DeGeneres, is up against it. Headlines like toxic work environment, sexual misconduct, harassment allegations. Generally, we have the pleasure of talking with Lainey Louie when she's at the Oscars or the Golden Globes or whatever. But thanks to Daniel, we're able to reach out and connect with Lainey, who is on eTalk, hosts the social, along with LaineyGossip.com. If you want to know the latest, go to LaineyGossip.com. Lainey Louie, what's going on with the Golden Girl of television?
It hasn't been a great lockdown for Ellen DeGeneres, and in a different way in the sense of it hasn't been great for anybody. At the beginning of lockdown, there were all kinds of rumors that emerged about how she's not the warm, kind, and fuzzy person that is presented on camera. And a lot of people came forward to share stories about how she was mean to them, how she was kind of like a grouch at best.
That sounds like you're being really gentle, suggesting that she's a grouch. Like, I would have chosen a few other words, maybe not even repeatable here in breakfast radio.
I'm trying to be diplomatic for your audience in the morning. I don't know if they want to hear bad words. But yeah, so all these stories started emerging, and then what happened was there were other talk show hosts who ended up dedicating their salaries to paying for their employees who were not able to work because, of course, all the studios had been shut down. And Ellen wasn't doing that. And then it emerged that while she was shooting her show from home, she wasn't hiring any of her staffers. She was using freelancers. And so that accumulated to, most recently, around the last month or so, existing and former employees of the Ellen DeGeneres Show have come forward to describe a toxic workplace environment, as you said, characterized sometimes by sexual abuse, sometimes by verbal abuse. They just say that it was an unfair, or is an unfair, workplace, and that something needs to be done. And so Ellen released a statement last week that wasn't great. She took accountability by blaming other people. So now the speculation is either whether she's going to step down, how she's going to clean up her own house, what the new season's going to look like. So everybody's looking at Ellen right now.
Holy, you know, here's this show that has flown so high. And then I'm seeing agents who are saying, I'm never going to book my clients onto her show again. So if the agents aren't going to book the guests and are not going to be requesting, can we, or whatever, can she recover from this? You know, if the agents don't want you and the clients don't want to go there, it seems like you're dead in the water, aren't you?
Oh, I think that's a bit of an exaggeration. I don't necessarily buy that there are a lot of publicists and agents who aren't telling their clients not to go to the Ellen Show. I think that sounds good right now, but when you consider that major celebrities like Kevin Hart and Katy Perry have already spoken in support of Ellen, and she's got a lot of powerful celebrity friends who are still behind the scenes friendly with her, I don't buy that. But there is work to be done, for sure, within the industry. Given that she is a leader, there are people watching and making sure that she is going to be accountable and takes responsibility and fixes the workplace environment. But you also have to remember, we're a little bit inside baseball. You and I are members of the media, so it's kind of our job to look at the headlines and to read all of this reporting. The public and some people who are listening to your show right now may have been introduced to this story for the first time. A lot of people are largely unaware of the intricacies of this story. For that matter, they're not like refreshing Twitter all the time. They're not reading The Hollywood Reporter. They're not reading Variety. Those are the key Ellen audience members who are going to keep coming back when the new season returns, who are going to be like, I know Ellen, or they think they know Ellen, and they're going to rely on what they know and what they've been watching the whole time and not on, you know, what's been said in The Hollywood Reporter.
Okay.
So this is by no means like an emergency. Like, everybody calm down.
Okay, so let's go to the other side of this, though. If she was exposed for being a chronic alcoholic, if she was exposed for being a drug user, or you work for Bell and so do I, if some of the things that are being alleged for Ellen were attributed to you, you would be dispatched immediately to HR. HR would say, Lainey, you're a nice girl. We want to keep you, but we're sending you off to conditioning or training or awareness training and so on and so forth. Does Ellen need to mea culpa and stand up and say, and I'm immediately going to dispatch myself into some wise counseling and better my ways?
Well, the production company has hired an independent investigator to come into the workplace and to make recommendations.
Wow.
She has agreed to that. And that's a good move. she's released a statement. It wasn't a very good statement, but that statement acknowledged all the reporting that has happened over the last few weeks. So it's not like she's running from it and saying, don't bother me, this is just speculation. There does seem to be a confrontation of the issues head on, at least publicly. Behind the scenes, what's happening now, I mean, that's the real question. Has she changed? Will she change? I think that, those are questions that, you know, are a big question mark and remain to be seen. But Ellen is a very powerful person. She is powerful because she has such a huge profile, but also she makes a lot of money for a lot of people. That show is so lucrative. So it's not as simple as, like, you know, buy Ellen or go to HR training. It's about an entire institution.
Wow.
That also, quite frankly, keeps people employed. They're not happy at work, but it is also a paycheck. They don't want to lose their jobs either, right? So it's about what is the best way forward for people to continue working, but having their workplace improved and not like an abusive situation, and also seeing how Ellen can turn her public reputation around.
Okay, so you've been doing this for a very long time. The number of times that I've had the privilege and pleasure of talking to you at an Oscar or a red carpet or the Grammys or whatever, you run with these people. You see them in off-camera moments when they're not there shining best and so on. Is this one of the biggest falls from grace that you've ever observed and watched?
I wouldn't say the biggest, no.
No?
Because, as I said, I really don't think that this is a this is the kind of crisis that we've seen in the past. You know, this isn't, I don't think, for example, this is Charlie Sheen. I don't think that this is, like, you know, the show hasn't been canceled. So typically when you describe a fall from grace, the show is gone. The show is yanked. And someone has to go into, like, public relations hiding. Ellen is not doing any of those things. Her show is still on the air. It hasn't been canceled. She is
They're already talking about James Corden being the possible replacement. I've seen those stories, and they registered with me.
Those stories, I don't think they're accurate.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, in the absence, for sure, this is a story and people are gossiping about it 100%, but then it gets spun off into all kinds of wild headlines. There is no way that James Corden is taking over Ellen's show, for sure.
I don't know. I wouldn't mind that. But, it was being positioned that here was his moment to step into daytime television kind of thing, that this was the next big leap for James Corden. And, quite frankly, I don't hang around the gossip side of the world very often, but even I found that intriguing.
Yeah, I think it's intriguing, in the sense of, you know, Ellen and what her brand was and why this story, if there were some people, there are some people whose brand isn't nice and be kind, right? So when stories come out about them and they aren't nice and kind, people are like, shrug, okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense. But it's because Ellen has branded herself, like her slogan is be kind. And so when you find out that, hey, she's not actually kind to the people she works with, that is what was so counterintuitive. But in terms of whether or not this has been enough to get her pulled off the air, no way. Like, if she's no longer on the air, it's because she doesn't want to be, not because the bosses will make a decision and say goodbye, Ellen. There is no way. Whether or not she wants to stick around is another story.
Lainey, I so appreciate this time. Lainey Louie, host of eTalk and The Social, and as well, you can find her at laineygossip.com. A look at what's going on. As Ellen DeGeneres says, she's sorry for a toxic work environment. It'll be interesting to see just how far this goes. Always appreciate the ability to access Lainey Louie. And you might want to check her gossip column, laineygossip.com.
This is the Early Edition Podcast with Phil Johnson on AM1150.ca and across the Bell Talk Radio Network.
Well, I'll tell you what, if your COVID-imposed quarantine is driving you batty and you're tired of looking at things online, if your Okanagan staycation is proving to be less than expected, I said at the walk-in here, have I got a tour for you? Bob Hayes is a friend of this radio station, occasionally contributes his voice, did a fabulous series called Voices from Our Past with a couple of other well-known historians. But his history would be that for many years was a history teacher in this city, loves the history of the valley and of this city and the surround. And he's doing something called Kelowna Pioneer Cemetery Tours, which suddenly it struck me that if you wanted to do something completely, totally, unbelievably different, you need to go on one of these tours with him. So he's agreed to join me for a couple of moments to talk about this. Mr. Hayes, good morning to you, sir.
And good morning, Phil. How are you this morning?
Fine. What was the inspiration for the idea, please?
It's got to be almost 10 years ago, Phil. I was working at the cemetery.
Yeah.
And offering tours, and they didn't take off too well that year. And then we got involved with Museums Kelowna, and Jen Garner is the coordinator at Museums Kelowna, and she's the education person. And, the last 4 or 5 years, we've just offered them regularly, and it's just taken off.
Okay, so Kelowna Pioneer Cemetery Tours. You're going to take me to a gravestone, and you're going to say, here lies a Fair York, kind of an idea, and then tell me who they were, why they were, what they were?
Right. There's actually four tours, Phil. We do a tour twice a week, Tuesday night and then Thursday morning. And then the next week we do a second tour and then a third and fourth. And typically what happens is I give a little introduction about the cemetery. It dates back to 1892, how it came about. I do a couple of readings about various topics. And then, for instance, this week's tours were focused largely on Chinatown and the Japanese in the area. And so we'll talk about things like Spanish influenza, which really hit the Asian community in 1918, or we'll talk about Kelowna's most important visitor of all time, Dr. Sun Yat-sen, who visited here in 1911. And then we stop at various graves, and I'll talk about Max Major, a man in Okanagan Center, for instance, who was a little bit different. We stop at the grave of William Russell Spears.
Can I just jump in here for a second? If I'm in Vancouver, I know that Vancouver has a fabled Chinatown.
Right.
If I'm in San Francisco, likewise. There's you know, a fabled district or whatever in those cities. Were the Chinese big players here?
Oh, yeah. We had a very viable Chinatown, Phil. Probably not as big as say, Vernon or Kamloops.
No. Okay.
Chinatown dated back to... late 1890s, and it was not a huge area. It was on the south side of Leon Avenue. If you know where Gospel Mission is now,
yeah,
that was where Chinatown was on that side, and then it spilled over onto the north side of Harvey Avenue between Water Street and Abbott. And then there were a few other buildings outside of Chinatown, but there were several hundred residents there in its day.
Now, were there big players within that community? Were there big players that had fiscal tentacles that sort of stretched out into the community? Or were they primarily here because that at one time, and I'm assuming, I could be wrong, but they had much to do with the building of the railway?
You're absolutely right. It was to do with the building of the railway. When the railway was finished in November 1885, they had nothing to do. And so some of them gravitated here. Yeah, there were some big people, players like Lum Locke, and there were sort of labor leaders, you know, that you would sort of sign up with a labor boss, because a lot of the Chinese men, it was mainly men, actually worked outside of Chinatown for most of the year. They were, you know, employed in orchards and farms, so they would be dealing with a labor boss. So, yes, there were a few powerful men in Chinatown.
Right. And were those men here in some ways in the same way that we have temporary farm workers that come here now? Were men sending money home to China to bring families here?
Absolutely. one of the things, problems, once the railway was finished, our federal government pretty much instantly slapped on the first of the head taxes, the idea being we don't need you anymore to build the railway, and we certainly don't want you bringing your wives out because you'll have children. And we don't want the they wanted the Chinese population to die off. Naturally.
Listen to what you just said, and talking about racism in this country, where we some have a holier than thou attitude that we're better than. It sounds to me like we were incredibly racist.
Oh, it was horrible. I mean, at one point you could buy a piece of property in Kelowna for pretty much what the head tax cost. To bring out your wife or children was virtually impossible. So we spent a lot of time in Chinatown, or not in Chinatown, the Chinese section of the cemetery. There's stories there, and look at a few of the grave markers. Unfortunately, we don't know a lot about a lot of the Chinese who died there because, well, there just wasn't the interest about recording their stories.
And yet I will tell you that when I have been to Banff, and if you go to the cemetery outside Banff and you walk through that cemetery and see the numbers of Chinese, headstones, if you will. And suddenly you realize, again, that without the Chinese laborer, the lackey, whatever you want to call them, punching the holes through the mountains, building the tunnels, laying the track, John A. McDonald's vision of this country and using the railway to tie it together would never have happened.
Oh, absolutely. Andrew Onderdonk, who oversaw the BC section of the railway, he could never have accomplished it without the Chinese. One of the interesting things, though, Phil, about the Chinese is there's a great number of Chinese who died here who are not buried here. They were. But for years, the Chinese government actually had a policy of disinterring remains and having them shipped back to China for reburial.
Wow.
So the earliest Chinese burial is in 1928. I think there's around, I think I figured it was around 40 or 50 men, there's no women buried up in the cemetery, whose remains were actually sent back to China for reburial.
And that was because your ancestors needed to go home to the land of their birth kind of
Absolutely.
Thing?
Absolutely. And I think maybe recognition that they weren't terribly well treated during lifetime where they were living. So why sentence them to eternity in such misery?
No kidding.
So we talk a lot about the Chinese, the Japanese, things like the Spanish influenza. Next week I'll talk about people like Dick Parkinson, Bernard Lakim, who founded the city of Kelowna, just different individuals.
So do I buy these as a series or I buy them as a one-off?
Individually. You can go onto the museum website, Kelowna Museums. You have to book in advance. They're $10, and we're only allowing 10 people because of COVID, 10 at a time. And we have sold out some of them.
Well, hang on here. So the tour costs me $10?
Yes, and that goes towards the museum.
And you I understand Bob Hayes just a little bit more, and your love of history of this valley, this city, and teaching. You're still a teacher, aren't you?
Oh, I love it. Yeah, and I love. The other night we had a couple of young people on the tour, and they had such great questions.
Okay, so let's talk to me about that. Is this this is clearly an all ages tour?
Absolutely.
And you're not getting me scrabbling up hillsides and whatever. No. It's fairly easy.
It's a very easy walk in the Pioneer Cemetery. It's there's no grass area. It's all sandy, and it's an hour and a half. And we go at a leisurely pace, and we stop along the way and talk about various people. And so it's not. Oh, I think we're the oldest people we've had are early 90s, and then we've had them down to about 5 or 6
Excuse me? Excuse me? Early 90s?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Fabulous. Fabulous. Okay, so very quickly, we've got a couple of moments here. So I get the sense of what this tour is, focusing primarily on Chinese immigrants' impact on the valley and so on. What are the other tours?
Oh, we talk about the polio epidemic of 1927, we talk about interesting characters like Captain Len Hayman. I read from various local history books. I talk about people like A.B. Knox. Knox Mountain is named after him. Dr. Boyce, our pioneer doctor. Causes of deaths amongst our early residents.
Yeah.
Social life. A woman I think of who should be of national renown who's buried up there, Sarah Jameson Craig.
Whoa! Why is that? Why do you say that?
She was a visionary. She grew up in, rural New Brunswick and in the 1860s, and she was way ahead of her time advocating things. So she's one of my favorites.
And how did she arrive here?
Her family was living in Rutland, and she retired here about 1915, I believe it was.
Right.
And so she came, and we talk about why people came here, and it's just a way to learn about our history.
Given your understanding of the very first people that came here, how the city developed, how it grew to what it is today, if you could pick any moment in time to go to and be alive and be living at that time, what would you pick?
Oh, I think probably around 1900 when the city was really booming.
Yeah.
You know, it was laid out in 1892, and those first few years, it was just humming and hawing. You know, they were just getting going, and people were arriving here. I'd like to have been here when the boats would pull in, the Aberdeen and the Okanagan and the Sycamose pull in at the end of the Bernard Avenue.
That would be magic, wouldn't it?
It would have been, Phil, yes.
And watching who would get off.
Absolutely, yes.
Bob Hayes, always, always my pleasure to welcome you into this show. Once again, if people are intrigued, and I'm sure there's a few, what do they do?
I'd go to the McClure Museum's website and follow the links there, and then you can order your tickets through Ticketbrite, I think it's called.
Yeah.
But go to the Kelowna Museum website.
And for the princely sum of $10, Bob Hayes will transport you back in time.
I hope so. But we will come back. I won't leave them there.
Always a pleasure, my friend. There is somebody that you want to know, and there's a person that you want to spend some time in company of, because when you say goodbye at the end of that tour, you will be much richer.
This is the Early Edition Podcast with Phil Johnson on AM1150.ca and across the Bell Talk Radio Network.
Well, in these days of housing prices seemingly ever ascending, sometimes going up like a skyrocket, there are all kinds of people looking for creative and inventive ways to approach the challenge of finding housing. And one of those is branded these days as tiny homes, tiny housing. You go to Google and just type in tiny homes, tiny housing, and you just be absolutely amazed at the thousands of websites that come up in the blink of an eye. We have one of those right here in our own backyard. It's Little House Contracting. Tara Schritter is the president and the founder of Little House Contracting. And I'm intrigued when I go to the website and seeing some of the endorsements and some of the things that are said about Tara and her company. Some of them exceedingly clever. Some of them verging on adulation. Did you know, Tara, that you just have some people who love you beyond?
Hi, Phil. How are you?
Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, thank you for that. We've really enjoyed working here in Kelowna. We've had a lot of incredible clients, so we've done everything from carriage home builds to small space renos so far, and we're working on our first small home development at McKinley Beach, which is really exciting, and we're excited to bring that product to our community.
So there's an entire community built around the concept of smaller spaces, smaller homes, smaller places.
Yeah, exactly. So these aren't tiny homes on wheels, so to speak, but they're smaller footprint homes between 1,100 and 1,250 square feet. And what we're aiming to do down there is sort of reduce the amount of land and space that is used by single family homes and reduce the environmental footprint of our homes. And also the amount of energy and the things that we consume in our homes by building smaller and smarter.
A moment ago, you uttered a phrase that I think was the starting point, the genesis, whatever you want to call it. You said, these aren't small homes on wheels. These aren't tiny homes on wheels. That was the pivotal point, was it not, to build small, not a house trailer, but a house on wheels that you could move if you needed to, when you wanted to.
Yeah, and there are companies that do that, and those are more like, you know, campers almost, and you can move them around and you can put them wherever. But one of the things that we come across is that when we're looking at putting them on land, our zoning bylaws don't allow us to do that. So those homes become more of a novelty as opposed to something that we're going to have as a purchase and an investment in to live in.
So take away the novelty idea and take away that. Really what it is well-designed, well-planned, incredibly creative slash inventive use of space to, I don't know, deliver maximum living room for individuals, couples, even single people, and to a degree done at a price that makes it affordable?
Yeah, exactly. So these are sort of like condo townhome alternatives. There's a lot of people that have been living in these size homes, but their walls are attached to their neighbor. And one of the things that we found out through research that we did was that a lot of people would like to live in a smaller space, but they aren't as drawn to being attached in the same building. And that's one of the that's been one of the barriers and one of the challenges is finding smaller homes that actually don't share a wall with their neighbor. So we were really lucky to be able to partner with a developer at McKinley Beach and offer this product to our community, which is something that we haven't seen here before in Kelowna.
Tara Schroeder is the president and founder of Little House Contracting. But in addition to building, I don't know, freestanding homes, my sense is you'll also do mother-in-law suites in existing homes or you know, a student's residence or what the heck, maybe just a mortgage helper.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. We're pretty flexible with what we'll do. Like I say, up until now, we have been building those carriage homes, those mother-in-law suites, because it is actually quite hard to find land that makes sense to build the smaller homes where you can actually make the dollars and cents work, because it's quite expensive to develop and purchase land in Kelowna, as we all know.
So right now, McKinley, and I'm looking actually at the Little House Contracting Corporation, I'm seeing the Little Flat, the Little Max, the Little Lux, the Little Loft, the Little Pad. And I think as I look at all of those littles across the bottom of your sheet, talk to me about the Little Pad.
Yeah, it's basically a little bachelor pad that's about 320 square feet. So it would be for somebody who, often people who are interested in that are maybe putting in their backyard for their mother-in-law or maybe an adult child who has a disability who wants to have a little bit of independence and but still stay close to home. So it's it's got its own kitchen, its own bathroom, and then a living, sleeping area. So it's totally contained, high ceilings, nice big windows.
How many square feet?
320.
That sounds like a retirement corner for Phil.
Yeah, there you go, Phil. I'll build you one in my backyard.
I can sit there with my laptop and write my memoirs.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, it's almost like an office space, too. I mean, you could use it as an office space in your backyard.
Listen, it sounds absolutely fascinating. I know that this is not sort of brand new. When did you kick this off? When did you launch the Little House Contracting Corporation?
Well, we've been working on this for 4 years. So we've been in the business for 4 years now. And like I said, we're doing our first development this year, which is really exciting. And we had we've started selling out there, and then the coronavirus happened, and it made us realize how much more important the way we live is as well, because of course what happens in one corner of the world impacts the rest of the world. So when we start to downsize and live more consciously here in North America, it actually impacts the whole world, just like we've seen this coronavirus impact the whole world. So
it's
pretty exciting time.
Isn't it frightening or amazing, whichever word you'd care to use, but isn't it frightening or amazing how COVID-19 has shrunk the world beyond anything we could have expected?
Absolutely. It is. It's absolutely astounding. And when you look at what we do day to day, I think this really has put the spotlight on how much the way we consume and what we do in North America can impact the world when we see how a virus that started somewhere else in the world can impact us.
And you have land that is calling out for people to for people to attach their name to it. What do they do to find you?
Yeah, they can go to our website, which is littlehouseco.com, and find out more. They can always give me a call or an email, and I can tell them all about it and send them some packages and get them started on their new home journey.
Dan says that there's also a link on our website as well.
Oh, that's nice of you. Thanks.
Tara, a pleasure. It's exciting, and when I'm ready to find that little corner of the world to start writing my memoirs, I'll be giving you a call.
Wonderful.
Have a good day.
Have a great day, Phil. All right.
Thank you. Truly a pleasure. Little house. No, not on the prairies. Little house right here in the Okanagan. The Central Okanagan's premier small space construction company, Little House Contracting. go online. Check them out.
This has been the Early Edition Podcast. Catch the Early Edition from 6 to 9 a.m. on AM 1150 and online at am1150.ca.